Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland. It's Monday morning and time now for the Old Mo Variety Hour, the show that digs deep into the issues of our day to expose the roots of our problems, and not just that, but to investigate what can be done. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, your host for the next hour. I struggled to think of a unifying theme for our variety show today, and not until the last moment did I realize we're talking about resistance this morning, then and now, against a variety of assaults on our right to be fully human and live lives of comfort and dignity. At the end of our show today, we're going to talk about the life and legacy of Staaten Lind, who died on November 17, just shy of his 93rd birthday. Lind was a scholar and activist who made a life of not only digging deep into the systems that oppress us, but also a life of active resistance to those systems. Before we get to our tribute to Staaten Lind, we have a book review by Larry Bolden of Geraldine Brooks' latest novel called Horse. It's a marvelous interweaving of stories about racehorses, scientists, artists, and blacks in bondage that takes up the very serious history of slavery and the resistance to it. Following that, Jan Hocken interviews Jacob Reisberg, an attorney with the ACLU, about the legal struggle to guarantee prisoners' rights in the era of COVID. To open our show, Bill Resnick speaks with Dave Finkel, writer, activist, and editor of the Left Journal Against the Current. The red wave predicted for the midterm elections did not materialize, and we are right to take comfort in the fact that a majority of U.S. citizens do not endorse the steady erosion of our democratic institutions and our civil rights. But as Finkel argues, we can no longer rely on the systems that guaranteed a measure of political stability and some semblance of democracy. The solutions to our multiple crises that are offered up by the ruling class will only dig us deeper into the mess. What is required is not just resistance to these self-serving corporate programs, but the promotion of an alternative left program for climate change and injustice that would actually work to create a better world. KBOO is your volunteer-powered community radio station broadcasting right here in Portland, Oregon. I want to thank our loyal listeners whose ongoing contributions to the station make this radio community possible. Now, here's Bill with Dave Finkel.
Hi, Dave Finkel. Welcome again to KBOO.
Great to be here.
Dave is the editor of Against the Current, a journal of the left. He is a prolific writer, publishes in Current Politics and many other journals. And he recently did an evaluation of the midterm elections. So, Dave, give us first a brief summary of your evaluation, and then I suggest we address two major issues you discussed. First, you pointed out that the factors that in days past stabilized the U.S. system of restraints and order, and the way it narrowly channeled class conflict and maintained relative peace, but all the stabilizing systems have become destabilizing. And second, you predicted that any positive steps on fundamental issues facing society are vanishingly unlikely, whether in healthcare, inequality, child poverty, racial injustice, and above all, about climate change. So, Dave, begin with your brief summary of the election.
Sure. Well, we try to think these things through from a socialist perspective and a movement perspective. My feeling was that the right-wing Republican project in this midterm, which they expected to sweep, was to, I would put it, carry on the project of the January 6th riot by more institutional means. That is, not only to put right-wing Republican majorities in both houses of Congress, but to go even further by potentially enabling legislatures controlled by the right-wing in gerrymandered states to literally overturn election results. and they were prepared to go to the Supreme Court with the insane doctrine of the so-called independent state legislatures in order to do this. I mean, that was kind of the farthest out dream. And the fact is that the right-wing project in this election failed. It failed because people turned out in large margins in support of abortion rights, in support of voting rights, in support of what's perceived as American democracy, and also in repudiation of some of the most extreme Republican candidates, many of them handpicked by Donald Trump, who were so bad that Mitch McConnell, of all people, said that he had a problem with the quality of the candidates. So there was all that, which I think has been widely reported and understood. Anyway, the project of continuing and carrying out the agenda of the January 6th riot fell apart. However, that doesn't mean that U.S. politics has stabilized or that the crisis is over. The crisis continues for a number of reasons, and this is where we get into the two things that you outlined. The enormous crisis confronting the society and the world, climate change, rampant inequality, rising rates of horrific gun violence in the United States, and racial injustice, so many other things. And also because the stability of the U.S. political system in the service of its elites has been guaranteed for a long time by certain institutions. One of them was the two-party system, where you have two corporate capitalist parties, one of them right of center, one of them either center or perhaps slightly left of center on some social policy and economic policy issues, alternating in power and agreeing on set of rules by which the political fight is carried out. And that factor of stability does not exist anymore because the Republican Party is no longer that traditional corporate conservative party. It's a party that I would compare to the Alternative for Deutschland party in Germany, far-right, anti-immigrant party, which has some support, but by agreement of all the other parties is kept out of any national governing coalition. Or like the National Rally in France, the Le Pen Party. That's what the Republican Party is now, as far as its dominant forces are concerned, with one chilling exception, which is that the far-right base of the Republican Party is heavily armed in a way that European far-right parties are not. So I think that's really a factor. Other factors that were intended to guarantee the stability of the system was that you have a court system with a Supreme Court at its head, which avoids peremptory radical changes in the system. And this Supreme Court is not that. This Supreme Court is not governed by conservative judicial principles. This Supreme Court majority, I call it W. SCOTUS, White Supremacy Court of the United States, is governed by an extreme right-wing judicial philosophy and by a project of essentially white Christian nationalism and misogyny. That's the Supreme Court majority, which is why its public support is at an all-time low, and that is where we are. The other thing, of course, another factor for the stability of the system, was the substantial decentralization of authority, where a lot of political authority rests with the states. Well, that's not a factor of stability anymore either, because you have crazy quilt where people's rights to vote, women's right to abortion, various other things are totally governed by where you live, not by rights that were considered for many, many years to have been guaranteed under the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. So things are in a wild state of instability. And of course, there is political turmoil in both of the capitalist parties, the Democrats and the Republicans.
Yeah, I think that's right. On the other hand, though, they can't sit back in the face of very strong public demands for action. And that's where the left comes in. We of our generation alive today can be confident that we have a better chance of predicting the future and being able to respond to it. We have a plan for dealing with climate change, and around the world, the left has an international plan that could work, and there's vast resources and productive capacity at our fingertips. Anyway, Dave, it seems to me we know that, And whereas you pointed out that the positive steps were vanishingly unlikely, it seems to me, yes, it's going to be difficult to, in fact, gain that public support, but it's quite possible because our plan will work and can be demonstrated to work. And the capitalist plan is quite absurd. Go very slowly using all kinds of technologies that they're now trying to invent. How do you respond to that sense of the future?
Well, okay. Everything you point out in terms of the trends is right. We have a serious problem in that both our political and economic system is incapable of dealing with it. Number one, because it's profit-driven, and number two, because it's undemocratic. For example, okay, we're being told by corporate America and by a billionaire like Elon Musk that the answer is the electric vehicle. Now, is that really right? The electric vehicle transformation means keeping intact the reliance on the individual car and on lithium batteries. Lithium is a rare element where the expansion of lithium mining creates its own environmental disasters and particularly a catastrophic impact on indigenous peoples. That's one issue. That decision is not being made from below democratically, being imposed because that's what General Motors and Elon Musk say is the answer in the future. And Elon Musk's performance at Twitter doesn't create a whole lot of confidence that he is capable of guiding the future of humanity. So there's that. And this problem is global as well. Take, for example, the fact that a third of Pakistan is underwater from the recent unprecedented monsoons. No one in Pakistan had ever seen a rainy season like that. But it's made worse by the way in which dams and irrigation canals have been built. This is a little technical, but parallel rather than perpendicular to the north-south flow of the Indus River, which means that when those floodwaters came pouring out of the mountains, there was no place for them to go. They're stuck in the fields. And the World Bank's answer to that, evidently, is to build more and bigger of the same kind of dams that have helped to create this tragedy. So, yes, I think what you're pointing to is that at the grassroots level, at the level of popular common sense, and the level of popular interest in solar and wind energy and, you know, renewables, the price of which, of course, is dramatically reducing. That's all true. But the institutional and corporate and political factors standing in the way are enormous. And that includes the fact that the Democratic Party establishment remains dependent on its corporate mega donors. That's just a sort of a tip of the iceberg outline, but you're right about the democratic instincts and impulses towards sustainability, but there are enormous obstacles in the way.
Yeah, Roosevelt said he was going to save capitalism. Capitalism wasn't interested in his saving them. There was sort of an isolationist fervor in the country. He was not able to enter the war against Hitler until Pearl Harbor. Then the political climate enormously changed, and the U.S. entered the war. It seems to me that what we can look forward to is something similar that awakens the people to the great threat, and that is when food prices begin spiking and all of the rest. But there's also a chance, it seems to me, in the Congress that at the time that it starts getting more, in fact, even right now, to get substantial appropriations for the buildup of community energy and local energy and building a few model cities, for example, in the United States that would become zero carbon. And there are already some that they're not quite what they promote themselves as, but still they're approaching zero carbon. It seems to me that we can begin demonstrating that the left program will work, and that their energy bills in those cities are much, much cheaper. We get sufficient recognition that much more local energy, and through either wind or sun, it's much cheaper, it can be demonstrated. And right now it seems to me the Progressive Caucus has some power in the Congress, and it might well be that we could do that kind of demonstration. I see that as the best chance for the left, or for, in fact, all of what we call civilization. It seems to me there really is room for hope, and in fact, it's part of a major part of the program of the left in the United States is to promote the demonstration of the necessity of moving towards that left, and there be democratically run on a local level, all kinds of participatory opportunities. How do you respond to that possibility?
Well, you're right about where the initiatives have to come from. I can't really speak to whether the Progressive Caucus has much power either vis-a-vis the Democratic Party establishment or particularly in a situation where the Republicans are narrowly taking control of the House of Representatives. Those waters are a little too murky for me to navigate. I would say, I know, Bill, you've done a lot of work and research on this, and the kind of perspective you outline is also, I think, eloquently put forward, for example, by Bill McKibben and other writers like Naomi Klein and George Monbiot.
And Robert Pollin has really done terrific work.
Right, and there are hopeful signs. Where I sit here in Detroit, I have to say, in Michigan, we're not seeing much of the alternative, sustainable energy impulse. A little bit. People can get a price break by installing solar panels, but there's lots of corporate greed around that. What we've seen a little bit more in Detroit, because there has been, with depopulation and deindustrialization, there are large parts of the city that are vacant. We are seeing some impulses, some initiatives towards urban farming, sustainable organic urban farming. I'm not totally up on the details of that, but I know that that's part of the grassroots communal initiatives taking place here. But I'm not sure what you may be seeing in a place like Portland isn't necessarily happening yet in the major industrial or post-industrial or whatever they are, Midwestern cities.
Dave, I think we have to sort of end it here. I have some hopes for the Progressive Alliance. I think we have to sort of grasp at the best possibilities, and Portland, in fact, doesn't demonstrate them. The IOUs here, investor-owned utilities, control the whole energy system and the Public Utility Commission. Anyway, Dave, we have to end the conversation now. So thanks a lot for talking to us today, Dave Finkel, editor of the Journal Against the Current.
Let me say it's been a pleasure, and there's a lot to think about and a lot to be done. Let me give you two websites. The Against the Current website is www.againstthecurrent, all one word. Don't forget the two T's, againstthecurrent.org. You can also go to the website of the organization Solidarity, which sponsors and publishes Against the Current, and there's an article there that I sketched out right after the election called The Smoke Clears Not, and that is solidarity-us.org. So you can find those two websites. They link to each other, and I think you'll find a lot of interesting material there.
Dave Finkel, thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Great, thank you. It's been a pleasure. We have a lot to think about and an awful lot to do.
That was Patti Smith in her 1988 tribute to democracy, The People Have the Power. Before that, you heard Bill Resnick and Dave Finkel talking about lessons for the left from the midterm elections. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Our history doesn't fade away, but rather lives on and shapes our contemporary lives. Perhaps that's the point that Geraldine Brooks is making in her latest novel, Horse, which interweaves narratives from 2019 with stories from the era of slavery, all involving racehorses. Bookmole Larry Bolden takes a closer look at the novel for us. As usual, I will be reading Larry's review for him. I know next to nothing about horses and am, at best, a sloppy historian. Geraldine Brooks knows tons about horses and is a superb historian. Her 2022 book, Horse, fascinated me from the first page to the last. Her character, Jess, in 2019, is an articulator. That is, a combination artist and zoologist who puts together skeletons. She is hired by the Smithsonian Museum to disarticulate and then rearticulate a famous horse skeleton. Dr. Catherine Morgan is a scientific researcher whom Jess has been assigned to assist. Says Catherine, quote, "One of my areas of interest is the effect of conformation on the locomotor biomechanics of the horse. Basically, I'm trying to determine what bone structure allows them to run fast while avoiding injury. To do that, I'm measuring and describing all the great racehorses whose skeletons are still available." Catherine stepped up to the exhibit label on the plinth and drew out her reading glasses. "Horse," she read. "I can't believe it. I don't suppose you people have the Mona Lisa stashed somewhere labeled Smiling Girl?" "Not just horse," Jess said. "The horse. What you have here is the greatest racing stallion in American turf history." End quote. Jess's story is just one of the threads in this magnificent historical novel. Jarrett is a slave on the farm of a famous horse breeder, not given a last name but identified by his owner's name as Warfield's Jarrett. His father, Harry, has bought his own freedom. Warfield gives Harry a racehorse named Darley in lieu of a year's wages, and yet it is against the law for a Negro to own a racehorse, let alone to race him in stakes races. So the horse must be officially registered in Warfield's name. It is Jarrett who raises and trains the horse, and in a manner that differs in important ways from tradition. Unlike today's thoroughbreds who are raced as two-year-olds, Darley is not even ridden until he is much older. Quote, "When can we ride him?" she asked. "Long time yet, Miss Clay. His bones got to grow. Best let that happen in its own good time." Harry, Jarrett's father, didn't hold with the newfangled idea of racing two-year-olds. End quote. Instead, the horses are not raced until they are four or older, and they are trained to run four-mile heats, sometimes three such heats in a single day. Alongside the story of Darley, the racehorse, there is in this carefully researched novel another more serious strain regarding slavery and the perilous lives of slaves who can be bought and sold on the whim of the owner. Jarrett's father intends to buy his son out of slavery, but he has already depleted his funds in buying the freedom of his wife and is counting on the purses from races to buy Jarrett's freedom. Jarrett has been close to horses from his infancy. "Look at him, he's half colt himself," they say about him. Quote, "The first bed he could remember was in a horse stall. He shared straw with the two geldings in the carriage house while his mother slept in the mansion, nursemaid to the mistress's infant. Jarrett hardly saw her. His first language had been the subtle gestures and sounds of horses. He'd been slow to master human speech, but he could interpret the horses, their moods, their alliances, their simple wants and many fears. He came to believe that horses lived with a world of fear, and when you grasped that, you had a clear idea of how to be with them. End quote. Much of this novel is about the mounting sense of rebellion among the slaves wanting to run and to be free, but so aware of the consequences if caught. Theo, an English horse painter, is well aware of how Negroes are depicted by artists and is writing a dissertation on the depictions of Africans in British art. Quote, he planned to write of coon caricatures, Oriental fantasies, the decorative enslaved servant in ornate livery, proffering fruit or waving peacock-feathered fans for a white master. His thesis argued that these paintings were never meant to be viewed as portraits of individuals, merely status signifiers of the privilege, wealth, and power of the white sitters. The reality of quotidian black life didn't merit depiction. End quote. This is a superb novel on so many levels, and the journalist and historian Brooks juggles the various stories with the same craftsmanship that won her the Pulitzer Prize for her earlier book, March. I've been talking about Geraldine Brooks' novel, Horse. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I'm Patricia Kullberg, reading for Larry.
Go down! Moses, way down in Egypt land, to let my people go.
Land.
Let my people go.
Oppressed so hard they could not stand.
Let my people go.
So the Lord said, go down.
Go down.
Moses.
Moses.
Way down.
Down
in Egypt land. Tell old Pharaohs to let my people go.
Let my people go.
Go Down, Moses is a song about Jewish liberation from slavery in Egypt, which was adopted by enslaved Africans in the U.S. and used to express their own yearnings for freedom. This 1958 version was by Louis Armstrong, backed by Cy Oliver's orchestra. Before that, you heard Larry Bolden's review of Geraldine Brooks's 2022 novel, Horse. Next, we turn to Jan Hocken, who speaks with Jacob Reisberg, an attorney with the ACLU, who has helped prosecute a legal battle in California to ensure basic human rights for prisoners in the context of a deadly pandemic. He makes the point that while these legal struggles are important, their success hinges on the pressures created by grassroots organizing for prisoners' rights.
Thank you for joining us today on the Old Mole, Jacob Reisberg.
Great to be here.
In 2020, the ACLU filed a class action lawsuit against the sheriff in Santa Ana, California, calling for the release of vulnerable and disabled people in the Orange County Jail and for addressing other health conditions at the jails. Well, you are policy counsel at ACLU and part of the legal team on this ongoing lawsuit. Can you talk about the significance of the case, which specifically addressed the impact of COVID on incarcerated persons?
Sure. I think to understand the significance of the case, it's worth just trying to take yourself back in time to the beginning of the pandemic and to think about what it was like to experience COVID at the very beginning, when We didn't know very much about COVID itself. We didn't know how it was transmitted. And we certainly didn't know how to protect ourselves against it. And what we started to see were these instances of mass outbreaks that were happening in confined spaces. So I don't know if you remember, Jan, the story of the cruise ship at the very beginning of the pandemic, where people were in close quarters, unable to be separate from each other. And that was a site of mass infection where essentially everyone was exposed.
And I think there was some outpouring of sympathy for these people that were confined under conditions not of their own choosing. And of course, jails and prisons are much worse than cruise ships and didn't elicit that same empathic response. We saw those cruise ships every night for a while in the news.
That's exactly right. And I think that part of the reason, just as you said there, that there wasn't as much of a public response based in empathy was because while the passengers on the cruise ship might be easy to empathize with or were shown in mass media, people in jail systems across the country are purposefully hidden away, sort of out of public sight and out of public mind, unless you're someone, as many people in this country do, who has a loved one who's on the inside and who could tell them what was going on. And that's exactly what we heard at ACLU SoCal, was phone calls from people inside the Orange County Jail, which, by the way, is the second biggest jail system in the entire state of California, with, at the beginning of the pandemic, over 6,000 people inside on average on a day-to-day basis. And we would be getting phone calls. I was getting phone calls from people inside the jail saying, what's going on? They're not giving us the newspaper. They're censoring certain articles. They're cutting things out. They've shut off the TVs. We know that there's something happening called COVID, but we don't know anything about it. And we don't know how to protect ourselves. And on top of that, we don't have enough cleaning supplies. They've not given us soap. We're running out of toilet paper because that too, as you remember, there were these mass rushes for supplies, not just in jail systems, but on the outside as well, where suddenly the shelves were empty. And that was affecting people inside the jail systems as well. And it got more and more to a state of just panic, with people saying, I don't know if I'm going to live or die in here. I don't know if I'm ever going to see my kids again or see my grandkids again. And it was that at the very beginning that made us say, okay, we need to try to do something immediate. And in the legal world, that basically means file a lawsuit.
One practical response was the push to release people who are incarcerated, who are no real risk to the community and are facing greater risks in jails and prisons.
Absolutely.
So that was part of this lawsuit, but I assume there's a series of steps before filing a class action lawsuit where you try to get the officials to respond.
Yes. And in some jail systems in the state, officials were more amenable to responding. The LA County jails took far more steps to depopulate because, just as you say, lowering the population, especially at that phase in the pandemic when we didn't have vaccines, and really the only way to ensure the safety, especially the safety of vulnerable people or the elderly or pregnant people, was to depopulate and just say, we're going to let you go because we think it's more of a public safety risk to keep you in here in this confined space where you could be exposed to this deadly virus or will be exposed to this deadly virus than it is to just let you go.
And do prison staff, correction officers enter into this at all? Because I know that was a part of the mix of the dynamics, was correction officers also bringing in infection from their own communities and also being infected and fewer of them to provide whatever care is available.
Absolutely. And one of our main arguments for why the only solution was depopulation was because it's just the reality of the day-to-day in and out of corrections staff that COVID would be entering the jail. Because at the end of the day, the day shift goes home, they go to their community, they get exposed to other people in their community, and then they come back in the next day. And that, we argued, was one of the major risk points of transmission into the jails, and basically meant it was a guarantee that COVID would come in, and it did.
How important is it in how these cases play out that prison staff, correction officers, who tend to be very politically conservative in terms of how defending these institutions and their growth, did they weigh into it in any different way or a way that was important in the dynamics of the lawsuit itself?
In terms of the lawsuit, there wasn't as much of an effect that came from individual jail staff. And by the way, the jail system is separate from the California prison system. And this case was focused solely on Orange County jails. So we didn't receive so much pushback from individual staff. Where there was substantial pushback was from the Correctional Officers Union, who basically said to the Sheriff's Department, there's no way we're going to agree to mandatory testing. There's no way that we're going to agree to leave that was connected to when someone was found out to be sick. Or there's no way that we're going to agree to mandatory vaccination, which came later down the line. So I think there was an impact by the institutional actor of the union more than by individual correctional staff.
And can you explain a bit briefly why that is? Why that has been such an obstacle to the movement for meaningful prison reform?
That's a great question. I don't think there's a simple answer, but what I do think is undeniably true is that correctional officers' unions, much like police officers' unions and sheriff personnel unions, are political actors that have political desires, that make strategic decisions to further those political desires. And I think it's a mistake. And I think it's a mistake that's made quite a lot in mainstream media and by many politicians, to assume that law enforcement interests are inherently neutral. I think that's a premise we need to reject. And we can point as evidence to instances like these, where there were clearly political decisions being made on behalf of the deputies by the union that were guaranteed to have negative health consequences for the people stuck inside the jail.
So maybe you can give us an update on where the case is now and what some of the dynamics are in the victory or the obstacles of these cases, whether community support is important or how you organize beyond filing the brief and putting together good arguments and compelling cases to illustrate the class. I know in looking at the brief, it was, you know, there's some very compelling individual cases that were thought to be compelling in arguing kind of morally for the lawsuit.
We're now more than 2 years after the start of the case, and it now has settled. We've both sides have agreed to a settlement agreement as of about 2 months ago, or a little more than 2 months ago. And the settlement basically says that the Sheriff's Department needs to ensure safety inside the jails, COVID safety inside the jails, in a bunch of different ways, like making sure that vaccines remain available and making sure that there are good isolation procedures if there are COVID exposures, things like that. I think some of the bigger victories that aren't solely because of the case but are connected to it is that the jail population is way down. I mentioned that on average at the beginning of COVID, the daily population in Orange County jails was around 6,000 people. It's now around 3,300 or 3,400, so almost half. And that was a combination of the litigation, lobbying of these institutional actors, and grassroots political pressure that basically said the status quo cannot stand. Some other things that I think are really important to recognize are, number one, the laws themselves are very unfavorable to incarcerated people. One of the reasons we settled was because we thought it was the best we could get and it was in our client's best interest. Because if we had gone to trial, there would have been a high likelihood that we would not have gotten as good a result for our clients. And that's because the deck is stacked in terms of the statutes, in terms of the case law, in terms of who the judges are on the courts on average and their perceptions of incarcerated people and what rights they deserve. All of those things make it an uphill battle for incarcerated people to basically demand dignity, humanity, safety. And so I do think that for me, one of the core lessons is that key to the fight, if not the biggest key to the fight, needs to be community-based organizing and grassroots organizing. And I say that as an attorney who's sort of working on cases all the time. I think the grassroots organizing is the only way that we will win liberation and meaningful dignity, meaningful safety, and eventual abolition of jail and prisons. And one last thing that I just wanted to add was, I do think that part of the strategy, just as you said, needs to be showing people and telling people, here are the human beings who are inside of the jails. Here's the pregnant mother who has to pump her milk and then, the mother who had just given birth, who pumps her milk and has her spouse pick it up at the jail. Or here's the 80-year-old grandfather who's inside still, despite the fact that he's already been inside for multiple decades. It's especially effective if people on the outside can hear from those people in their own words, with audio recording or other ways of reading people in their own words, rather than having it be transmitted via a lawsuit or some other way like that. But I do think that that's essential to the picture. I also think, and this is the last point I'll make, that I did see people on the outside start to get it, in the sense of seeing the interconnectedness between people on the outside and people on the outside. And I think that was directly because of the pandemic. And what I mean by that is, if you're on the outside and there's a rampant outbreak of COVID at the Orange County jail, those people are going to have to go to the hospital, and they're going to fill up the hospital beds in Orange County. And so that when you on the outside get sick or your child gets sick, there's not going to be a hospital bed free for you to get care. And that was the reality. That happened not just in Orange County, but all over, where there were hospitals at 0% capacity, in part due to these concentrated outbreaks. And so I think that helped people on the outside start to realize, oh, there's actually an interconnectedness between what happens here on the outside and what's happening inside the jails.
And of course, jails and prisons, perhaps particularly by design, ought to be removed from people psychologically and geographically and physically. So I think that point is so important, as well as having a little bit of a feeling of being trapped or confined under conditions not of your own choosing. Of course, there's a big difference between that, what we all experience, and incarceration, but it did seem to open up possibilities for different levels of understanding, as you say, of our interdependency and shared humanity. So I hope you come on the program again to continue to follow this and this important broader work. Is there a place people can go to for an update on the case? I was looking online today and didn't see a recent update. You can also get back to me on that if there's something coming up.
I can get back to you on that. I think we're waiting to see what happens with this winter and whether there are new variants or new outbreaks that may lead to us trying to reopen the case in some meaningful form.
Okay, so hopefully we'll have you back on the show to talk further. Thank you so much, Jakob Reisberg, for being with us today, and keep up the good work.
Thank you for having me.
Icy wind burns and scars, rushes in like a fallen star through the narrow space between these bars, looking down on prison grove. Down, hours race without a sound, gonna carry me to where I'm bound, looking down on prison grove.
That was Jan Hawkins speaking with ACLU attorney Jakob Reisberg about legal battles and grassroots organizing for prisoners' rights, followed by a clip from a 2003 song entitled Prison Grove by Warren Zevon. His song laments the plight of a prisoner in an unheated jail cell during the cold heart of winter. To close our show today, I'd like to read excerpts from a tribute to our fallen comrade, Staaten Lind, an author, activist, labor lawyer, and historian who died on November 17. In this tribute, his friend and fellow activist, Andy Piasek, summarizes Lind's legacy to the left. The article, originally written several years before Lind died, is entitled Forever Young, Staaten Lind. It was published online in Countercurrents on November 21st of this year. You can find a link to the full article on the Moles webpage at kboo.fm. Suddenly, Staaten Lind is all the rage, again. In the last several years, Lind has published a number of new books as well as new editions of classics, such as Rank and File, plus a memoir co-authored with his wife, Alice. In an epic of imperial hubris and corporate class warfare on steroids, a Lind revival could hardly have come at a better time. Soldier, coal miner, 60s veteran, recent college graduate, there's much to be gained by all from a study of Lind's life and work. In so doing, it's inspiring to discover how frequently he was in the right place at the right time and, more importantly, on the right side. During the tumultuous summer of 1964, Lind was invited to coordinate the Freedom Schools established in Mississippi by the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC. The schools were an integral part of the Herculean effort to end apartheid in the United States and become models for alternative schools everywhere. That August, Lind supported the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, or MFDP, at the Democratic Party Convention. Led by Fannie Lou Hamer and Bob Moses, the MFDP had earned the right to represent their state with their blood and their extraordinary courage. Instead, the party hierarchy supported the official and illegal delegation, a pathetic band of reactionaries who, the irony is too delicious, supported not the candidate of their own party, Lyndon Johnson, but his opponent and their ostensible enemy, Republican Barry Goldwater, for president. In early 1965, Lynn spoke at Carnegie Hall in one of the first events organized in opposition to the U.S. invasion of Vietnam. A short time later, Students for a Democratic Society, or SDS, asked him to chair the first national demonstration against the war, where he was again a keynote speaker. That April 17, a crowd of 25,000 turned out in Washington, and what would become the largest anti-war movement in U.S. history was born. Later that summer, Lind helped organize the Assembly of Unrepresented People in Washington, timed to coincide with the 20th anniversary of the murder of tens of thousands of civilians in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The gathering also included a rally at the White House, where peace with the people of Vietnam was declared. Lind has recalled the bemusement with which the relatively small band of demonstrators was received by those charged with protecting the government from its people. In reply, Lind told a military police officer that they were the first of what would eventually be millions, a statement that sooner than anyone could have imagined proved prophetic. By 1967, a majority of people in the U.S. had declared peace with Vietnam. Lind would continue as one of the seminal figures of the 1960s. He was both a tireless organizer and the author of numerous articles in important movement publications. With Michael Ferber, he documented the movement against the military draft in The Resistance, one of the best books about 60s organizing. Lind was an enthusiastic supporter of the New Left and embraced precepts like participatory democracy and decentralization. Ex-radicals of his generation, like Irving Howe, Bayard Rustin, and Michael Harrington, by contrast, spent much of the 60s attacking SNCC and SDS. Lind spoke for many when he mocked their enthusiasm for Johnson and the Democrats as a, quote, coalition with the Marines. This, too, proved uncannily prophetic. Within a year of being elected in 1964, Johnson, one, ordered a massive escalation in Vietnam, two, sent an invasion force to the Dominican Republic to support military thugs who had overthrown a democratically elected government, and three, armed and funded an incredibly violent coup in Indonesia in which over a million people were killed. The peace candidate, indeed. At the end of 1965, Lind made a fateful trip to Hanoi, where he witnessed the carnage inflicted by U.S. bombers. Up to that point, he was one of the most promising new scholars in the country. Upon his return, however, his career in academia was essentially at an end. A tenure-track position at Yale suddenly disappeared. Department heads at other universities enthusiastically offered teaching positions only to be overruled by higher-ups. Lind never looked back. He became an accomplished scholar outside the academy and one of the most perceptive and prolific chroniclers of history from below, with a special interest in working-class organizing. From a series of interviews, he and his wife Alice produced the groundbreaking book Rank and File, which begat the Academy Award-nominated documentary film Union Maids. Lind moved to Ohio in 1976, became an attorney, and when the mills in Youngstown began to close, assisted steelworkers in an unsuccessful attempt to take them over. In a book he wrote about the effort, the fight against shutdowns, Youngstown's steel mill closings, Lind explored the biggest little secret of all, one that people everywhere would do well to heed. We who do the work can build a better world, and we can best do it without the parasitic super-rich who contribute nothing and weigh us down like a monstrous ball and chain. Lind has seen more than his share of colleagues come and go. Some flamed out after a brief period of frantic busyness. Others moved on to different lives and nice-paying gigs. Well into his 80s, Lind offers long-term commitment, long-distance running, as he calls it, and accompaniment. Professionals living alongside workers and the unrepresented and contributing much-needed skills to the struggle for freedom, all the while walking side by side as equals. He also believes, as passionately as ever, that a better world is indeed possible. That tribute was written while Lind was still living by his friend, longtime activist, and award-winning author, Andy Piasek. You can find a link to the article on our webpage. That's a wrap for our show today. I would like to thank Moles, Bill Resnick, Larry Bolden, and Jan Hocken for their contributions, and John Nelson for his editing assistance. A special thanks to our guests, Dave Finkel and Jakob Reisberg. As always, we are grateful to the staff at KABU whose tireless work keeps community radio alive in Portland. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been your host for the hour. I'm going to leave you with one last classic song from the 60s, an era during which Staten Lind was making his mark on the New Left, and who certainly understood what singer and activist Phil Oakes was talking about in his 1966 takedown of liberal politics. The song is called "Love Me, I'm a Liberal." Thanks for listening this morning to The Old Mole. Tune in again next Monday morning for more views, reviews, and interviews from the ground up.
In every American community, you have varying shades of political opinion. One of the shadiest of these is the liberals. An outspoken group on many subjects. 10 degrees to the left of center in good times. 10 degrees to the right of center if it affects them personally. So here then is a lesson in safe logic.
I cried when they shot Medgar Evers. Tears ran down my spine. And I cried when they shot Mr. Kennedy. Though I'd lost a father of mine, but Malcolm X got what was coming. He got what he asked for this time. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal. Get it?